KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, international economist, special advisor to the United Nations, and head of Columbia University's Earth Institute, Jeffrey Sachs, will be joining us to discuss his newest book. It's called Commonwealth, Economics for a Crowded Planet. We'll talk with him about real solutions to poverty and population problems and how to develop new technologies and new paradigms. That's all next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Jeffrey Sachs is director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University and special advisor to the United Nations Secretary General on the Millennium Development Goals. He has worked all across the world as an economic advisor to governments. In fact, New York Times Magazine said he's probably the world's most important economist. And we've been doing a lot of programs on sustainability lately, and he has certainly much to say on that subject. He's also advised many international organizations. Wrote the New York Times bestseller, The End of Poverty, which he spoke to us about here on Forum. And his newest book is called Commonwealth, Economics for a Crowded Planet. Joins us for this hour. And welcome, Jeff. Good to have you back.
Michael, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, there are a lot of new economic paradigms in here, a lot of solving of problems. Pretty impressive, in fact. Let's talk about this first in terms of what you describe as clinical economics. You want to find out exactly what the diagnosis is and give some prescriptions. I think that's probably a good metaphor as any, isn't it?
Well, I've been married to a wonderful clinician for many wonderful years, and I've watched her as a clinical doctor, pediatrician, apply science to the cases of individual patients. And for a long time, I asked myself, why can't economists do the same thing? Economics is not very good often at getting down to context, at knowing the difference of the challenge in a place like Ghana or Ethiopia from the challenge in a place like China or India or Bolivia. And over time, as I've had the opportunity to work in all corners of the world, I've seen first that the challenges have such an important local context, and that grew on me over time, of course. And I've also seen how Washington gets it so wrong by failing to know the local context. That's where the idea of clinical economics really emerges.
It's a dismal science, but it can be local, right?
It can actually be better than a dismal science, as it's called. It can actually solve problems if the tools are applied on the basis of evidence and local context.
Well, you're talking here about something that's not exactly utopian, but when you talk about goals, end of poverty, 2025, a lot of people say, can that really be done, of course, and immediately the skeptical antenna go out. Or you're talking about population stabilization to 8 billion by the year 2050. And what I was struck by in reading your book was you're saying these are not pie-in-the-sky goals. These are goals that are absolutely viable and can be reached. And the real problems are, for the most part, the kind of hurdles that are put in their way as opposed to really reaching those goals.
We live in a time, maybe understandably, where people feel we can't solve problems. We've had such incredible ineptitude and incompetence of the Bush administration that maybe that's a convincing argument. Problems can't be solved. But of course, they can be solved if we take a different approach. This has been faith-based foreign policy, the faith of the president. This is what we're going to do. This is how it's working, despite
evidence.
I'm
the decider.
Exactly. And what the book is about is how to take a large problem, whether it's the continuing rise of the global population or climate change, dissect it to its core components. What are the causes? What do we know about possible solutions? How much do they cost? How can they be implemented? How can one approach the issue at the scale of the problem, which these days is global, not local? And therefore, how can we think about practical solutions? And this approach is pretty straightforward. It's a little bit of engineering, I would say, but it's not what we do right now. and we could do it. I find the chorus of "No, we can't" among pundits and elites, if I could put it that way, in politics in many places in the world, disconcerting because it becomes self-fulfilling.
Well, part of the problem is cynicism and defeatism, as you point out in your book, isn't it?
I've had an incredible experience. I gave a series of lectures last year for the BBC called the Wreath Lectures, which is a wonderful opportunity because it reaches around the world. But the first of these lectures I gave at the Royal Society in London, which is where Isaac Newton and his friends started modern science, in essence.
It's also where Jim Lovelace is presently a member, talking about nuclear power. But
right,
we may get to that.
And here were leaders of UK society, scientists, politicians, and so forth, assembled for the first of these lectures. And I gave a talk about the need for global cooperation in the areas of climate, ending poverty, and stabilizing population, themes of Commonwealth. And I ended my talk thinking, well, that was pretty normal and straightforward. I hope someone learned something. And then I was amazed by the wave of cynicism. Well, that's all fine, Professor Sachs, but there's no way we're ever going to cooperate. No way we can reach international agreements. No way we can actually carry that out. So all fine and good, but we're not going to do it. We're going over the cliff. And these were the people that are somehow in a privileged position to help make change. And they were just taking the inevitability of crisis as a matter of fact. This is shocking indeed. Now, in our country, it's a little bit different. Washington is absolutely not even aware of half of these challenges. And the president, I wouldn't put it at one quarter of the challenges with any awareness. We're fighting war. We're spending hundreds of billions of dollars squandered in Iraq, prospects of trillions. And we're not taking on climate, water, food. Now we have food riots across the world because of the soaring food prices. Well, these kinds of things are foreseeable. And there's actually a tremendous amount of scientific and technological knowledge available on how to address these problems. I spend my time working with the expert communities, whether in growing food or controlling malaria or alternative energy systems. The knowledge is pervasive, but it doesn't reach right now action. Markets don't give the right signals, and the politicians are spending our money and lives on war rather than on peaceful development.
I want to talk about some of those new technologies because, in fact, you've written about them in Scientific American, and we're talking to Jeffrey Sachs, whose new book is Commonwealth Economics for a Crowded Planet. But first, let's go to the heart of what you've just said, which has to do with attitude. And I mean, because, as you said, a lot of your ideas, the real construct under them is the idea of global cooperation and fostering global cooperation because we have common ground here. We have to care for the resources and save the planet. I mean, the stewardship of the planet is at stake with respect to global cooperation. I guess some of that cynicism is bred by a host of reasons, but some of it is the idea that when you talk about social justice, which you do, it seems to strike people as almost synonymous with idealism, number one. But I think even more than that, people think that sovereign states have their own self-interest and they're not necessarily going to cooperate on any voluntary basis. They're going to be simply interested in their own concerns and their own self-interest, period.
Well, let me put it this way. Even if we just have our own self-interest, there are smarter ways to do things and dumber ways to do things. And we're doing a lot of the dumber ways right now. For example, climate change is not just about them. It's about us, obviously. The American West is experiencing a mega drought right now, which will get worse as the climate worsens. This is not an issue that we could solve on our own. Even if the United States miraculously did all the right things, and we're doing very few of them right now, China has become the largest emitter of carbon dioxide in the world. And China will change our climate even if we stop changing the climate.
Right.
We need global cooperation to solve a problem like climate change. That's true of saving the fisheries. That's true of the acidification of the ocean, which is coming from the greenhouse gases. That, again, is a global phenomenon. That's true of fighting terror, because at the root of the terror is instability of failing countries, We've learned the hard way, though it was utterly predictable, that armies can't stabilize hungry and poor countries. Only development can.
Is the root of terror really that, or is it more ideology and religious fundamentalism?
No, the root of terror is the root of the risk for us is failed states, where there are places that can then draw on a broad public support for large organizations. And it is the collapse of places like Afghanistan or Somalia that are our biggest threat, because individuals and their ideologies by themselves may be obnoxious, but they are not a threat to us. What's a threat
to us? They
need
sanctuaries.
Sanctuaries and bases of large public support, and that is fed by state failure, by hunger, by unemployed young people, by the lack of government of any kind, as in Somalia, or the ability of radical governments to arise in the first place. And this becomes a matter of foreign policy. It's not really a matter of ideology. It's a matter of foreign policy. Why are there large failed regions? I work in those places, and I see people are hungry. People are distraught. People have no future. Food crises are getting worse. Water crisis is getting worse. And there's no way in a million years that the American military is going to solve those problems, or with the vast populations and rapidly growing populations, that somehow we're going to take care of it by force. We've learned that. We can't even control the road from the airport to downtown Baghdad. And that's for the most powerful army in the world. It's the wrong assignment for the army. And so when you look at the swath of instability in Chad, in Sudan, in Ethiopia, in Somalia, up through the Arabian Peninsula, Yemen, into Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, the thing people should notice, which they don't notice, is that's a hungry region. That's a water-stressed region. That's a place of mass unemployment of young people. This isn't Islamic extremism that we're fighting against. This is a place that does not have a future in the world unless we do much better. It doesn't have, a prosperous place in the world right now. It's facing a lot of crises. And the problems there need to be solved much more directly and at the base. If we directed our attention to work with Tehran on the water stress, or to work with Kabul on prosperous agriculture, not just poppies for heroin, but actually a livelihood for the people in the region, we'd find an outpouring of interest. It's when we put troops in there, when we say we shoot to kill to get our security, that we find that there's just an explosion of anti-Americanism and an inability to get to the root cause of these crises.
Well, the Millennium Project and the advice that you've been giving to Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and the United Nations has really made some important incremental steps, and maybe just not even incremental, some real progress in terms of ameliorating poverty and hunger problems.
The ironic thing, and this is, if I could convey one point, there are such powerful, straightforward things we can do that if we do them, the results are phenomenal. An example recently is UNICEF with its campaign to give measles immunizations to children in Africa has reduced measles deaths by 91% in the last 7 years, saving millions of lives at such low cost. Bed nets to fight against malaria could bring that disease decisively under control. Wells, water for pastoralist populations in the very places of instability right now could give livelihoods to places where instead what we're doing is sending counterinsurgency forces. You can't solve the problem of insurgencies when there's mass hunger. And so we should be sending counter-drought forces. We should be sending engineers to help build water points. And incidentally, Michael, you know, it's an irony. The generals agree with me on this. I'm contacted by so many military leaders that say we need to understand better how to help impoverished communities. They've been tasked with the wrong assignment. Our military needs to be strong to defend us against invasion and so forth, but they can't solve problems in Somalia or in the Ogaden Desert or in Sudan or in Chad or in Yemen. These are impoverished places that need help. They need clinics, veterinary care, a future for the livestock, some basic infrastructure like electricity. And those things come at a tiny fraction of the $700 billion that we'll spend on the military this year. So I think one of the most worrisome things is when Senator McCain says that the transcendent challenge of our time is Islamic extremism. This is just getting it completely mistaken. It is treating a symptom, not treating a cause.
Well,
it comes back to the clinical economics.
To the medical metaphor, yeah. I mean, you're talking about interrelatedness in a kind of almost anatomical way between poverty and the need to ameliorate poverty and world unrest and planetary cooperation and all the things that you're advocating. I want to get back, though, to China, which you mentioned earlier, because I think I mentioned the statistic that you brought to my attention. China's building one large coal-burning power plant a week right now, and there is this sense of growth that's going on in places like China and India. You say we can't necessarily stifle that economic growth, nor should we perhaps be presumptuous enough to feel that we ought to be stifling it. So you're talking about restraining emissions. You're talking about new technologies and the need for new technologies and a whole – this is a Scientific American article that I'm – but a lot of it's melded into your book as well, Commonwealth. The idea that we need more applied scientific research just as a beginning, as you know, initial step, but also more regulation, which a lot of people chafe at, of course. But let's talk about some of these new technologies, because you're talking about some that are viable, low-carbon technologies and a kind of a Manhattan Project that would produce more things like that, or hybrid cars. Or, I mean, there's lots of stuff that's there, you're suggesting. Yeah?
When we get serious about technology, as we've done with health wisely, we created the National Institutes of Health. We spend, and the results show it's been a huge benefit, we spend about $30 billion a year on helping to identify new medicines, new drugs, new approaches to disease. And the returns have raised our well-being and extended our lives markedly. It's been a great investment. We're spending right now about $3 billion a year on sustainable energy technologies in an era of mass crisis when the costs could be trillions and trillions of dollars of disaster, whether it's the peak oil or whether it's the climate change that will result from our current technologies. We are not investing, in other words, in sustainable technologies, even though the engineers are clamoring. They have this approach or that approach. They have concentrated solar thermal in the Mojave Desert, which could provide more than half of America's electricity from clean and renewable solar radiation. They have plug-in hybrids that, with improved batteries, could be giving us, indeed, the 100-mile-per-gallon automobiles in the not-too-distant future. They have carbon capture and sequestration. So at a coal-fired power plant, before the carbon dioxide goes up into the air, it is captured and put into safe underground geologic deposits like basaltic rock formations. There are many, many things that can be done. Markets by themselves do not solve these problems because private companies don't have the incentive to engage in the basic scientific research. They can't cover the very high initial costs of a demonstration project. They can't solve the regulatory liability and public acceptability issues on their own. And until we put a price, and let's call it what it is, a tax on carbon emission that makes it not a freebie to put carbon dioxide up into the atmosphere and wreck the climate, you won't have the private incentives to take care of any part of the value chain, as it were, going from the basic science up through the spread of sustainable technologies. And that's true within the United States, but as we've been saying, since China's now the largest emitter and they're the ones building the coal-fired power plants at the most rapid rate in the world, they have to do this as well. And for that, we need to negotiate. Their point would be, well, fine and good, but you're the biggest emitter per capita. You've been doing this for now decades. How about helping us with this technology rather than expecting us to solve your problem, the one you've been neglecting, as they might say to the United States.
Or they might also say, and this came up in some conversations we had with people like Bill McKibben, you have SUVs, we want to have SUVs. You know, whatever it does to the environment, that's immaterial. You've had this progress, now it's our turn. We're a developing nation, and we're entitled.
What's interesting is, of course, they say that they're still at one-fifth of the per-person income of the United States. They want their place in the sun, like you say. India, even poorer, maybe less than a tenth of the average income in the United States. But they're not reckless about it. They actually don't want their SUVs. They'd like long-mileage automobiles. China has tighter automobile standards than the United States. They know that they're very vulnerable to these changes. Indeed, remember that China has about 22% of the world's population and only 7% of the land area and only 6% of the water resources. So for them, the environment has the economy by the neck, and they know it. So they're worried about these things, but they're also saying they too can't solve this by themselves. They've watched the Bush administration hide from this problem for 7.5 years, and they can't take this on by themselves either. They say, help us with technology. We'll be partners with you.
What you're saying is so inviting. We're all in this boat together. We've got to navigate through it somehow. We've got to be symbiotic and rely upon each other. There's mutual dependence here. The planet is at stake, and somehow humanity has to realize that. This is a big educational project, isn't it?
It's a funny thing. Of course, I have this perhaps unusual experience. I'm an American in a time when, in a lot of places in the world, Americans are not too welcomed. But since people see that I'm coming at these issues from a global point of view, not as a representative of the Bush administration foreign policy, but as an academic, a scientist, an advisor at the United Nations.
Friend of Angelina Jolie.
Friend of Angelina Jolie. That's got to be a good thing. The level of first trust is very high. That's an important point because it means that if we approach these issues right, we'll find partners everywhere. Second, what I feel, because I'm lucky to be in very high-level discussions all over the world, these issues, food, water, energy, climate, these are the first issues on everybody's minds. It's not like they're sitting around hating our freedom, as we were once told in large parts of the world. They're wondering, where's their food supply going to come from? What's happening to the water? What's happening to their climate? What's happening to their unemployed youth? These are the things that are really on the minds of people around the world. They want to solve their own problems. They wouldn't mind some help and partnership in doing it.
We're coming up on a break. Where do you stand on privatization of water? Opposed?
Well, I think that the way that it's been done is really dangerous in a lot of places, and it's led to a lot of water riots. So that has to be handled with great care. Water is life, as the expression goes.
Jeffrey Sachs is with us. He's the author of Commonwealth Economics for a Crowded Planet. And I should mention that he'll be speaking at the Santa Clara Convention Center at noon today and tonight at Herb Theater at 8 p.m. And you can talk with him if you have something you'd like to say or if you have a question or comment. You can join us now, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Our toll-free number for your calls is 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free from anywhere, 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls and your emails. You can email us simply by sending an email to forum@kqed.org, and when we return, we will go to your calls and emails. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Jeffrey Sachs, and he is internationally renowned for his work as an economic advisor to governments and international organizations around the world, author of Commonwealth Economics for a Crowded Planet, and also he's director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University and special advisor to United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon on the Millennium Development Goals. Want to remind you also that Jeff will be speaking at the Santa Clara Convention Center at noon today and tonight at Herb Theater, be interviewed by Roy Eisenhart at 8 p.m. on stage. And we're going to go right to your calls here, and let's not even tarry. Let's go right to John in Sausalito. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Mr. Sachs, we're discussing these huge vectors and factors of crises, food, water, war, peace, and everything. Don't you think it's awfully useful for people to get a handle on things, to try and tackle things region by region, sort of one region at a time, that is to say, the carrying capacity of one region and its inhabitants at a time? Thank you.
John, thanks a lot. Yes, of course, except to say that these days the carrying capacity of a region is actually globally determined. Many regions in the world are going to become uninhabitable, in fact, in terms of food production because of global climate change. Many regions right now are either upstream or downstream in watersheds that are under tremendous stress.
Do you remember Garrett Hardin? You
know, sure.
Malthusian economics who said we're beyond the carrying capacity, we've moved beyond the carrying capacity, we can't keep the population going because we can't sustain the population.
The first book that I was assigned as a freshman at college in economics was Limits to Growth, of course. That was back in 1972. It said we've overshot. But my professor assigned it to make fun of it because mainstream economics has ridiculed that idea. The fact of the matter is that while technology has kept most of the world ahead of crisis, even as the population has grown, the pressures we're putting on the planet right now in a global scale are alarming. And the old nostrums, well, we've always done it before, doesn't make it automatic we're going to do it again. My book is optimistic. I say there are resource-saving technologies. In other words, we can cut emissions and have our electricity. We can use water more effectively. We can save the oceans, but not with the technologies we have right now.
But the caller is raising the question, should we be thinking more locally than globally?
We need to think locally, but understand how the local is connected to the global. And we can't believe that any region by itself can solve even its local problems if the global problems are unattended. Because if we don't get climate change under control, for example, no region is going to escape tremendous change, and some will have catastrophic change. And so these are truly global scale challenges right now that need to be faced. We know that a lot of the pressures on the planet now are putting human society into contact with animal diseases, whether it's SARS or avian flu, or AIDS, which, of course, began as a chimpanzee virus and became a human virus. And these spread across borders and regions also. So even the control of disease these days, of course, has to be carried out locally, but has to be thought of as a global phenomenon.
And let's bring more of our callers in. Laura, good morning.
Hi, Hi. Dr. Sachs. Thanks for taking my call, and thank you so much for such a great book.
Thank you.
And I've been sharing it with everyone. First of all, I think one way to kind of scare people into what you're saying is to have them watch Soylent Green, which I just did.
Right.
But anyway, my question is, my parents recently started a scholarship in China, and they provide monthly stipends to needy students in several high schools and colleges. And it really allows these students to buy sufficient amounts of food. And maybe some school supplies that they really need. But I was curious in just reading your book and kind of teaching them how to fish mentality. Can that money be used more effectively to address underlying problems that have put the students and their parents in this position?
And you're speaking, Laura, about China. And remember that the situation is vastly more dramatic in many places in rural Africa, for example. So what we're trying to do in the African context in particular is to work with villages. I describe it in the book, what we call Millennium Villages, which is to help invest in the villages in a number of areas interconnected. Agriculture, which is usually the livelihood, schools, including school feeding and ability of kids to go to school, in health, so that there's at least a primary health center available, and in basic infrastructure, the theory being that what communities need is to escape from extreme poverty so that they can then carry on their own investment and saving, often with microfinance, their own economic development so that they can take on these challenges on their own over time. I would also suggest in the China context and more generally that with the spread of internet connectivity, which is very widespread, even in poor places, linking our schools to schools in China and in Africa in terms of direct connections of students, curriculum, teaching, and so forth is very important for us to understand the reality of the world that we're in. We're launching at Millennium Promise, an NGO which I've helped to found, a school-to-school program so that American schools and African schools can be linked together via the internet in joint curricula, and our kids can learn not just out of a book, but by direct connection with the rest of their generation that they're going to be growing up with.
One assumes, though, that especially in some of these impoverished African nations, like in South Sahara and everything, there's not much in the way of accessibility to internet.
Well, the fascinating thing is that with the wireless connectivity coming for cell phones now, the technologies actually allow for wireless internet together with the cell phone technologies. And cell phones really are reaching across even almost the most distant places in rural Africa.
Yeah, I have now, difficult this times in South San Francisco sometimes picking up cell phones.
Well, this doesn't mean that people have cell phones or that they have computers, but it does mean that we can help them to tap into the potential connectivity by helping them with the hardware since the connections are already there. And we're launching with schools in Uganda, Malawi, and other places this kind of connectivity. Ericsson, by the way, is working with its partners in Africa to really ensure that you get actual internet connectivity into impoverished rural villages. It's a marvelous way to promote economic development.
You also mentioned microfinancing, the kind of thing that Muhammad Yunus and others are doing. This is really making a difference, isn't it?
Microfinance is terrific. It should be understood as one arrow in the quiver. It's not by itself a solution to impoverishment. If you have microfinance but you have no roads, no electricity, no schools, no clinics, it won't work. So microfinance is one tool to add into a mix of basic tools. I believe in a holistic approach to helping communities and regions escape from the poverty trap.
Let me bring on more of our callers. Cynthia, joining us from Winters, California. Morning, Cynthia.
Good morning. I so wholeheartedly agree with your premise, and I've actually been saying this for years, and I'm super thrilled to hear there's a book out about this, but what do we do as individuals to help in promoting this international cooperation?
Thanks, Cynthia. And I'm sure you were there first. There's nothing amazing for us, all of us, to figure these things out once we get past the fear factor, I think, because so much of what's gone wrong, Cynthia, in my view, is we're not thinking straight because there's a lot of fear-mongering going on. And if we don't continue to bomb and we don't continue to do this, all heck's going to break loose and so on. And the fact of the matter is that it's fear that continues to grip us when what so much of the world is crying out for is cooperation. So what do we do? I think first we understand we are at a crucial political crossroads. I think people get this. If the view is going to be that Islamic extremism, that's the number one thing, and we're going to invest hundreds of billions, even trillions of dollars trying to track that down and kill it, no chance that we're going to get this right. If the idea is that we're going to actually talk to those who we consider our adversaries, we'll find out that we have some common ground and some common need, we're first going to get somewhere. So politics is really important this year. Understand the issues, be on top of them, and push our politicians, who, remember, are not leaders in general, they're followers, to do the right thing. Second, work within your business, your school, or your community to take on some part of this challenge. So many businesses, Cynthia, are coming to me right now saying, we have technology, what can we do with it? And generally, there are wonderful things that they can do with it, whether it's for disease control, helping poor communities to get online, more connectivity. So I believe that our churches and synagogues, schools, and businesses all can play a role in a leadership way showing what can be accomplished, helping to lead the way, and finally pulling our government along in the process.
And Cynthia, thank you for your call. We're talking to Jeff Sachs. His new book is called Commonwealth: Economics for a Crowded Planet. That's a little play on words there, Commonwealth. Obviously,
well, it is a Commonwealth globally, but global, it's two words, Commonwealth, because that's really the fact. We have a common fate on a small planet, and either we're going to squander that wealth or we're going to build it.
From Los Angeles, Jonathan, join us.
You're Hi there, Michael. Hi. I love your show. Thanks for taking me.
Thank you.
And I had a question for the doctor. Actually, I had two. I'll ask my first one to see if you want to take my second one. First of all, I applaud everything you're doing with the environmental stance, but I do have a question when it comes to what you said about Islamic extremism. It just seems to me to be a little disingenuous to say that it has nothing to do with the fact that they're Islamic extremists, but that they're impoverished, because there's all places all over the world, Central South America, India, where there's abject poverty, but there's no terrorists coming out of those areas. So I wondered what he had to say about that.
Thanks, Jonathan. A couple of things. First is, I think that our most effective approach to terror, which is real, is first, you know, direct policing and action against terrorists, of course, but also depriving them of a large base of operation, freedom of maneuver, and broad-based public support. And what I'm saying is that in that case, that comes from places like Somalia that are in massive crisis, often so bad that there's effectively no government. So it is a bit of about the larger base of operation that I think is key.
I think you're right about that, but the leadership has come not from those who are hungry or those who are in abject poverty. The leadership has come from people like bin Laden, who is a billionaire.
Absolutely, because you need resources for this, and you need resources and a base. And so I'm not saying that every terrorist or every extremist is impoverished, but I'm saying that the legions of people that are in conflict right now and that are fighting or are giving sanctuary or are in the frontier provinces of Pakistan where bin Laden presumably is hiding, those are very impoverished people. And they feel some humiliation, but much more than that, they feel pangs of hunger. And if we were helping those kids not to have either no education at all or to be in madrasas, simple memorization and so on, rather to be in proper school and funding, we'd actually be making a lot of headway. But where did our $11 billion of money to Pakistan go during the Bush administration? It went to military spending. Instead of helping Pakistan find a way out of poverty and a way out of growing environmental and water crisis in exactly the regions of instability, we were giving them money to buy arms. And where do those arms end up getting turned one time after another on us? So the idea that we're going to arm desperate populations to fight our enemies and not expect that those arms don't get turned on us is just a fallacy.
Also propping up Musharraf, who seemed to be an ally, and, you know, we get into the whole geopolitics of that.
Yeah, well,
after
9/11. Knew all along that that is an unstable and risky place, but unless there's an economic future, and for places like the frontier provinces with Afghanistan, there is no solution that's going to come through the NATO troops there, and that's what we see over and over again. And this isn't hindsight on my part. This was utterly predictable, and roughly half of this country predicted it. Unfortunately, in the fear and in the misguided leadership that we had, this country marched off to war, and now we're seeing, so many years later, the disastrous costs of all of that.
Talking to Jeffrey Sachs, his book, again, is Commonwealth: Economics for a Crowded Planet. I'm going to go to more of your calls, but first here's an email from a listener named Matt. It says, Africa's population was stable until Western technology and aid interfered. If we help Africa against disease and lack of water, will the population just grow to the next crisis point?
The population was perhaps mostly stable, but because roughly one out of every two children died of hunger, a disastrous kind of stability. In the 21st century, we don't need that kind of disastrous, quote, stability. We need populations where children survive and fertility rates are reduced down to what's called the replacement rate, on average about two children per household. And that's how it is in much of the world. But in Africa, where the mortality rates of children have come down, but not so far, and where the fertility rates remain high, you have very high population growth rates continuing, the population doubling roughly every 25 years. It's a disaster for them, and it creates massive environmental and other social and even geopolitical crises as well. So what my book talks about in a couple of chapters is how to bring about a voluntary and quick reduction of the fertility rate. And first, start with saving the children. Then the households have the confidence to reduce the number of children that they're having because they're confident that their children will survive. Help the girls in particular to stay in school through high school to delay the age of marriage and the onset of sexual activity and the onset of child rearing. Have family planning be available. This became a dirty word under the Bush administration. We don't talk about contraception and family planning. We cut off the funding for the UN Population Fund. It's a disgrace, but most of all, it's contrary to our national security needs. We've just gotten that wrong. Help women to be empowered and more economically productive through things like improved agricultural technologies, because when the value of the mother's time goes up and the income goes up, they also say, come on now, I've got income earning opportunities. I don't want to spend my all the reproductive years raising seven or eight children. The fact of the matter is we could help to have a quick, voluntary reduction of fertility rates down from current levels like six children down to three or fewer within a decade if we worked at it, and at a tiny cost compared to the cost that we're going to pay for this continuing massive growth of population, which is no favor to the poorest of the poor themselves.
Before I go to more calls, when you're talking about global cooperation, global agreements, global compliance, somebody might ask, where's the teeth? Where's the enforcement of this? I mean, it's the same thing with fertility. You know, you have to institute something that's voluntary.
Indeed, our whole society, even internally, depends on agreeing to follow the rules that we set down for ourselves. So you could say we have laws in this country, but laws are disobeyed unless they're supported, unless we say we'll follow through. Internationally, we also have laws. We call them treaties. If you check the Constitution, our international treaties should be national law. But we're blowing off those treaties right now. It's like saying we don't care about law. But the Constitution's very plain. The laws of Congress and our international treaties are both part of our national law. Now, we signed, for example, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change back in 1992. Bush Sr. signed it. But the current president has not even noted that we have signed this, not told the American people, while we may or may not disagree with Kyoto Protocol under that convention, we have very clear legal obligations to work to stabilize greenhouse gas emissions. In other words, the administration is not following our own law because our treaties are part of it. And there are several treaties. I would mention the Geneva Conventions, of course, also, which shockingly this administration
blew off.
There's
the heart of the problem, though, in terms of, as I said, having compliance or teeth to the kind of treaties when you're talking about global cooperation.
If we are, yeah, but that's on our side. That's self-fulfilling. So if we work towards global cooperation and say that we take this seriously, we build up the basis of international law and respectability. If we blow it off and then say, oh, law doesn't work because we don't obey it, that's not a very persuasive argument to me.
Even given our obedience to all the law, you still have rogue states and states who, again, can find, I don't want to sound the note of skepticism here, but, you know, they
can follow their
own interests and follow their own concerns, whether it's building something nuclear or whatever it may be.
But the quite amazing thing is, first of all, for issues like climate change, say, these are not rogue states. China and India are not rogue states. They need to be partners with us, and we need to negotiate with them. We're not even at the negotiating stage because we walked away from the negotiating table. And then I would remind us that even rogue states, like Libya, of all places, Muammar Gaddafi.
No, they've come around more.
they came around when we put an offer of business on the table, basically. We said
it was a big carrot, but it was also Gaddafi's son, you know, who kind of turned things around, I think.
But the point is we shouldn't presume that we have enemies forever if we never even talk to them. And this idea that we've had it in the campaign, we don't even talk to the other side. We just know these are implacable foes. This is really a very foolish policy. And President Kennedy was right when he said, let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate. That was a very, very smart posture. It actually saved the world in the Cuban Missile Crisis and afterwards.
And we'll negotiate some more callers here for you. Tim, good morning.
Hey, good afternoon. Calling from San Francisco.
Yes, sir.
My question is, what level currently is there of a sense of consilience amongst, or to use E.O. Wilson's word, or his book title anyway, consilience, jumping together of knowledge amongst the arrows in the NPO and NGO quivers globally? And are there orgs that focus primarily on creating a mortar, a global mortar amongst these organizations? And if not, shouldn't we focus on the sort of jumping together of such camps of knowledge, technologies, and resources? Thank you.
Tim, a great question. You also use my favorite word biologist, certainly, and one of the greatest scientists of our age, E.O. Wilson, consilience, the jumping together of knowledge. I believe, actually, there's been a huge progress in recent years to understand that if we're going to fight extreme poverty, for instance, we need the knowledge of the agronomists combined with the malariologists, combined with the hydrologists or water specialists, combined an economist or two once in a while should be let in there. We do need a much broader base of knowledge to get these things right. Similarly, if we're going to solve climate change, we're going to have to put the climate change, the energy, and the development issues together. So I think that there is building this kind of sense of connectedness. I was delighted when Bono and Al Gore, Bono coming from the Africa side and Al Gore coming from the climate side, starred this year at Davos at that annual business conference by saying we have to bring the climate community fighting climate change together with the anti-poverty community because these are intrinsically interlinked issues. In a world where there is no single global conductor, all of us have to be working to build that kind of consilience. But I think one way to help do it, and it's a point I stress in my book, let's keep our eye on goals that we've agreed to, specifically the Millennium Development Goals, where we have a timetable, very specific agreements. The U.S. has signed, like the rest of the world, to fighting hunger, poverty, and disease.
How are we doing with respect to that timetable?
Well, President Bush has mentioned Millennium Development Goals one time, as far as I know, in a speech in 2005. He's kept it hidden from the American people. That's part of the disaster. We're behind, but they're still achievable. The next administration's going to have to pick up the pace dramatically. And let's remember, we have global commitments on climate change as well and on many other areas. So let's be consilient by keeping our eye on the internationally agreed goals and doing the various things needed to meet those objectives already agreed to worldwide.
And that's a real beginning as far as global cooperation, too. I mean, if we can achieve those goals, is it not?
In my view, the fact is we've made all the promises and commitments we need to make for the near term. We just have to follow through on our words. We've had an administration that has absolutely turned its back on the international community at enormous cost to American blood and finance and reputation around the world. We need a dramatic change, and maybe we're going to have one.
Let me get back to fertility and population with you, because you're talking about stabilizing world population to 8 billion by the year 2050 as a result of voluntary reduction of fertility rates.
That's correct.
You see that, forgive my choice of words, or you conceive that as definitely happening?
Right now, the somewhat optimistic medium forecast of the United Nations is that we're going to reach more than 9 billion by 2050. So what I'm saying is let's pick up the pace considerably. Now, a number of governments in high fertility regions, specifically in Africa in the last couple of years, have said, oh my God, this population problem, our farm sizes are way down, water is scarce, food is scarce, we got to get this under control. And yet, here's the U.S. Government saying, we're not giving any money to the U.N. Population Fund. At the same time, they pr- they say they're helping our security. We're incoherent in our own policies, while some of the poorest places are just now waking up to the disaster that would be caused if the poorest places in the world continue to have a doubling of populations every 25 years or so. We can help them. We need to move quickly. It is a global objective.
Let's get Ed on while we have a couple minutes. Ed, you're on.
Hi. Great program. I'm a physicist, and I really have gaps in my knowledge about economics, and I've been shameless and it's hopeless, and I just got black lightning, and that's just, I don't know. They're telling me that you increase wages, the increased inflation compensates for that, and I just doesn't make any sense to me. So do you have any kind of bibliography? I'm not afraid of math, but you might well, I mean, I like it, but you might want to recommend some non-math for other people, but I'm just asking for a bibliography, things to read to catch up.
Well, Ed, I hope you'll read Commonwealth because it really tries to lay out an integrated framework that I think is physicist-friendly and general reader-friendly. It's not filled with the math or equations. It is basically saying, here's something that all of us can grasp, the interconnectedness of population, poverty, energy, environment, and I think it's a good starting point. It's got lots of references, and you can follow up from there.
And we wish you good luck with that, Ed, and we certainly have been glad to have you here with us, Jeff Sachs. Again, Jeffrey Sachs will be speaking at the Santa Clara Convention Center noon today and tonight at Herbst Theater, 8 p.m.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And we thank you for being with us. Again, his book is called Commonwealth Economics for a Crowded Planet. We'll be back with you, if all goes according to plan, on the morrow. We thank you for your listenership. I want to also thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory and Tina Larberg, Nick Vadinsky for production assistance, and Danny Bringer, our engineer. Also, executive producer of Forum is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.